Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am going to comment once again on Christian Mingle. Just think of the idiocy of that. Did God decide that even though he couldn't and wouldn't inspire Bible translators to get his message consistent, to get it right, that he was instead going to spend his time inspiring software programmers so that the ones and zeros would all come together and work in favor of bringing little Christian heartthrobs together? Or does God spend his time inside of the computer saying, okay, I want these dots now to make a connection? And should you not find a mate on Christian Mingle, does it mean that your God does not like you? Or worse, you find a mate and the mate turns out to be horrible and that the relationship's terrible. Does that mean that God hates you even more? I mean, this is just so moronic. Turning to the passages we've been considering in Dabarim, I hear these last few days, Dabarim words 5:9. God said, "For indeed I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God, reckoning the consequences of twisting and distorting of the fathers upon their children unto the third and fourth generations of those who hate me." So the question is, why is God jealous? Why is jealousy appropriate? And why are these things being connected? Why is reckoning the consequence of distortion of the fathers upon their children a consequence or related to jealousy? It's all one sentence. Does it not explain the nature of love, the nature of a family? Does not a father of a loving family have to hate? That God is explaining it for you here as clearly as words allow. He hates those who corrupt their children because it precludes their children from becoming his children. And he's jealous because he recognizes that the only way that he can demonstrate his love for these children is to hate those who corrupt them. It is why it is inappropriate for us to speak nicely of religion. It is why it is inappropriate to be tolerant of religion. It's why it's inappropriate to respect someone's religion, even if that religion is socialist secular humanism. When we show tolerance of things that twist and corrupt the truth, we're being unloving. The only way to be loving is to be jealous, is to want to protect those you love from harm, and to despise, to be intolerant of, to oppose those who would corrupt the truth, harming their own children. It's a profound thought. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that God equates corruption to hating him. He is saying that when you engage in the process of twisting and distorting the truth, since he is represented by the truth, and you twist and distort the truth to lead your children astray, that by doing so, you're showing animosity to him. So when Paul condemned, misquoted, diminished, annulled Yahweh's Torah instructions, according to God, that was a hateful thing. That he did so not because he loved God, not because he was devoted to God. He did so because he actually hated God. And those who promote his myth today as Christian ministers, as Christian evangelists, are also showing that they abhor and loathe God. Now, by his own admission, Yahweh is emotional. He can love, which means that he can hate. And that's good and bad depending on where you stand with him. The prospect of being despised by the Creator for being unfaithful isn't something that should be taken lightly. And yet that's exactly what most Christians are wont to do. They present their God as being a jovial father figure, a jolly accepting spirit who loves all of his children regardless of their religion or behavior. Well, that God is a myth. That God is an idol. We'll discuss in the news segment tomorrow Pope Francis's most recent slip of the tongue as he said, God saves everybody. Some would say that Satan's capacity to hate demonstrates that angels can love. But there's no scriptural evidence of Satan hating God or man, or of any demonstration of love among the heavenly host. An unrestrained ego does not require an emotional motivation to rebel, to deceive, or to damn. Satan wants to be seen as God, and thus he has deceived man into worshiping him as such. Tolerance isn't a scriptural value. Tolerance isn't a godly value. God's way too merciful for that. Yahweh is absolutely and revocably intolerant. Because the consequence of our religious, our political, and our academic perversions of his Torah is devastating to our children and to our children's children. This fact will be further reinforced as he concludes his introductory statement in a couple of verses. But think about this for a moment. When a whole continent is compelled through fear to embrace a religion, that continent becomes savage. Look what happened in Europe during the time that it was controlled by Roman Catholicism. Today, our schools, our media, and our politicians are all evangelists for political correctness. And so the children raised by yesterday's children are now all incapable of exercising good judgment. They're incapable of being moral. Even if they could process facts, they can't discriminate. They think being judgmental is a crime as opposed to the means to be rational, the means to be moral. And so what we have done is prove that God is right, that corruption corrupts generations, and generations corrupt the next generation. With God, it is his way or the low way. As Creator, it's, of course, his prerogative. Life is a matrix, and he sets the parameters. Personally, I think he is intolerant because truth is absolute and because this life is nothing more than an exercise in choice. God wants us to spend our eternity with him, but likewise, God wants to spend his eternity with those who want to be with him, with those who respect him. And that means that he doesn't want to adopt or spend time with those who reject him, who insult him, who ignore him, who corrupt his message. Can you imagine being God and you're off leading a grand journey through the universe and teaching people how you conceived life or whatever it might be, just exploring, and every time you say something, you've got a joker in the back who twists and corrupt what you said because he doesn't like you? What is that going to do to God's enjoyment and to the rest of the people's enjoyment? It's the reason why there will be no religious people in heaven. Now, while religions all lead to the same place, that place isn't to God. The victims of man's religions and human institutions were all given the gift of life and choice, but when their lifespan is over, it's over. There's nothing more. That is, unless you consider oblivion a destination. For them, the popular song with the catchy tune is right. Imagine there's no heaven above, no hell below. It's easy if you try. The mortal souls of those who trusted human schemes, who believed human schemes, who placed their faith in human schemes like Christianity and Islam, even socialist secular humanism, of course Buddhism as well, will simply vanish into nothingness. But that's not the end of the story. There is a heaven. There is a place, although not called hell, that serves similarly. God's home and total separation from Him would be the definition of these places. Heaven is a spiritual abode. God always refers to it in the plural as Shamayim. And as Shamayim, there is both the universal heavens, the universe, and then, of course, there's the spiritual abode of God. That's why it's Shamayim. And with hell, it is Sheol. It is a place that is separated from God. Now, most souls will not experience either of these two places. Those who hate God, those who are hostile to God, those who are opposed to God's instructions as they are delineated in the Torah, and who actively lead others to that same position will be punished for twisting, perverting, and corrupting His testimony, and for leading many astray. You can't have done what Paul did and not receive a consequence for it, a punishment for it. So, the likes of Paul, the likes of Muhammad, and those who have taken up their mantra will join Satan and his fallen spiritual messengers in the abyss. Those who heed this divine instruction, those who choose to love God and respect His prescriptions for living, those who embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, well, they're going to spend their eternity with their Heavenly Father in His home. Simply stated, there are rules for life. Yahweh demands exclusivity in His relationship with us. There's only one way, one truth, one source of life, one Savior, one covenant, one Torah. You can choose to ignore Him, and He will ignore you. You can choose to hate Him, and He will hate you. Or you can choose to love Him, as He presented Himself in these words, and He will love you in return. Those are the choices. It is the purpose for life. There is no punishment for those who simply choose to ignore God or choose to form a relationship with a false God. But there is for those who lead others astray. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We've been discussing Yah's word, His presentation of the way that He has designed for us to transition from this life to eternal life for those who choose to avail themselves of what He has offered. And as He has been listening to this, we've had Nick call in from Wisconsin, and I understand your question, Nick, is where did Yahweh come from?
Yeah, well, everything has its own beginning, so I'm guessing mm-hmm. Yahweh does too. So where did He start?
Yeah, what He tells us is that His name is based on the Hebrew verb Hayah, which means exists. So Yahweh defines Himself as I am. That He just says, I am. I exist. I was. I am. I will be. And so God's presentation of Himself is akin to light. You know, with light, there is no beginning, no end. There is no sense of time. You know, when we ask questions from our perspective, what's the beginning, what's the end? And so, you know, you and I, both stuck in time as we are, we view that everything has a beginning, everything has an end, and we're somewhere in that process. Well, with light, which is what God equates Himself to, that perspective doesn't apply. On a photon of light, time simply is. There is no past, there is no present, there is no future. Everything is now. And so God's nature as light simply is. He's kind of like the Hebrew language. You know, the Hebrew language doesn't have tenses like English does. The verbs aren't stuck in time. The same thing
with the Russian language too.
Oh, okay, so it's very much the same, and so God's presentation is that He simply is. Now He tells us a fair amount about Him, but Himself, but certainly His presentation of Himself is that He has always been. But He tells us that He is most similar to light, which means that He is spiritual energy, as opposed to matter. It tells us that He created the universe, told us that He authored His Torah, told us that He does engage from time to time in human affairs, presents Himself as Father. Pretty humble presentation, all in all,
so then,
of His nature.
Short answer to it would be that He, Torah says that God have, Yahweh have no beginning and no end. He works.
Correct.
And He is, and He will be.
Yep, yep. That's the when He met with Moshe to free His children from political and religious corruption in Egypt and enslavement in Egypt. First thing that Moshe said is, all right, first of all, I don't want to do this because I'm a stutterer. That does not qualify me. That disqualifies me for speaking for God. Your God, you could do better than a stutterer. Once Moshe is saying, you're really not going to give up here, you really want me to say yes, that I'll do this. And finally, when Moshe agrees to do it, he said, well, at least tell me, because the first question I'm going to be asked is, by the children of Israel, is who is this God that is trying to save us? And he gives him two answers, both back to back, and both to answer different questions. One is, what is His nature and what is His name? And the first was, what is His nature? And he says, I am who I am. And he uses Haya to explain that Haya is the Hebrew word for exists.
Well,
so I exist.
I have one more question then.
Sure.
Where is the God located? Where is He? Where is He? What you know? I mean, where does He locate it?
Where is He located?
Where is
His
home? Where is His home?
Yeah, that's another interesting question. He does describe that a lot. God says that His home is in the Shamaim, the heavens, and He always uses it as plural. Shamaim, heavens, plural. He uses Yisrael, and particularly Jerusalem, is to say in the material world, His home is part of our planet, is in Yisrael, and particularly in Jerusalem. When He's not at home in our world, which He isn't at this moment, then His home is in the spiritual realm that is part of or associated with the universe. So He doesn't give us a specific location for that, other than to say that it is a spiritual realm that is set apart from the material universe.
Is it out in space?
Well, the universe itself is this enormous space that is probably 15 to 30 billion light years across. So we'll have to return to that. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. We're talking with Nick. Nick, your last question was, is God's home in the sky, or is it apart from the material universe? And the fact that he uses Shamaim in the way that he describes it indicates to me that it is apart from. It's not part of the universe, but apart from the universe, outside of the universe as we know it.
Okay, well, but there could be another universe or something to it. I mean,
Yeah, there's certainly a possibility that God created a second universe. We know He's going to create a new universe. He's told us that. He says that when after his millennial Shabbat, he's going to create a new universe. He actually has to, for us to be transformed as light. In other words, for us to be able to maneuver in time. Because as light, we're going to be just like God. We're simply going to exist, which means that we can travel great distances in no time, and we can go back in time and forward in time as spiritual energy-based beings. And so what God has to do is create a new universe for us to explore, because otherwise we would be saddened by this one.
Would it be safe to assume that his home, maybe not in this universe, but in one of those that he has created at one point of his existence?
You know, I don't think there are multiple universes. It's certainly a possibility. If there is, we're not told about them, so it'd be pure speculation. I do think that his spiritual abode is apart from this universe, as opposed to a part of this universe. I think he created this universe as, just like if you and I wanted to create an ant farm, we would create our ant farm inside of us and probably not in the midst of our home, but outside of our home. I think that's the nature of this universe, that it is set apart from him, and that his spiritual home is apart from us. So that's probably the best answer I can give you.
What would you call space between him and us, or between stars, or between universes?
Well, the physical universe, the empty space is the term that we use, is just space, because it is mostly devoid of both energy and matter. It's not completely devoid of energy and matter, however. It has a temperature degree Kelvin, so there really is no empty space, but yet it is mostly empty between planets, between suns, between stars and galaxies. And the best we can tell, it's the universe as we are able to detect it is some 30 billion light years across. So it's an enormously big place.
But there are parts of space that have absolutely nothing in them.
That's what we originally thought, is that the space between planets, the space between stars, the place between galaxies was empty. But we found out that it really isn't empty, that there's an enormous amount of energy and matter that permeates what we thought was empty space. So I don't think it is completely empty. And then we've also got, Nick, the challenges of trying to understand that 96% of the universe is comprised of two things that we're unable to detect, we're unable to describe, that we don't even know anything about. One of them is what we call one dark energy, and we call the other one dark matter. And the reason we distinguish between these two forces that are responsible for 96% of the substance of the universe is that one is repulsive in nature, the other one is attractive in nature. The dark energy is repulsive in nature, that the dark matter is attractive in nature. And so 96% of what's out there in space, Nick, is something that we cannot effectively describe.
The reason why I'm asking is because mm-hmm. when you said that if we would reject mm-hmm. Teachings, mm-hmm. Then after our body expires, mm-hmm. we will disappear into
right.
nothingness.
Correct. Our soul ceases to exist.
And so nothingness is the key. What do you consider to be nothingness?
Yeah. The way that God describes it, he's got three things. There's the spiritual realm. which is eternal. There is the material realm, which decays, and then there is ceasing to exist. And while our physical bodies don't deteriorate into nothingness, they came from the material components of the universe, and they return right back into the stuff that the universe was made out of. So our bodies are recycled, if you will. Our soul, which we can't measure, there's no energy component, no mass component to our soul. According to him, it just ceases to be, which means that it no longer exists. No longer exists means that consciousness, which is our soul, is essentially consciousness. It's the ability to observe and react to our environment, that those who reject his invitation to form a relationship with him at the end of their life, they cease to be able to observe their environment, they cease to be able to respond to their environment, which means that there is no sensation of any kind, no input, no output. That's what ceasing to exist would be, no input, no output.
Okay. And the last thing I want to tell you, my final experience with Jehovah's Witnesses.
Okay.
If you will.
Sure.
The first time, I don't remember if I told you, the first time my wife had told me either me, either they, because it's like, she was like so against the Jehovah's Witnesses coming over and talking to me. And, well, after a while, they, you know, randomly, they go back, apparently, to those houses that told them not to come.
Right. And, yes, I'm one of those, too.
After I told them that I will convert them, the next time they'll show up,
yes.
They're not coming anymore. There's no more witnesses, and I didn't even have to say, please don't come. I just said, please come again. I'll convert you the next time you'll show up.
That's funny. Yeah, that's kind of...
And what they said, they didn't even know what was a store or maybe
wow.
Lied. Because they're like, oh, it's what Jewish will believe in. I'm like, funny.
Yeah, well, you know, what's funny, of course, is that their translation of the of their Bible translation, their approved Bible translation, it begins with the Torah. They just don't know that it's called the Torah. And what's really weird is that a huge proportion of the tenets of the Jehovah's Witnesses come out of the Torah. So they are really confused. But that's the whole nature of religion, that people are just programmed.
Thank you for taking my call.
Always a pleasure, Nick. We're going to go to Glenn, who is calling in from Philadelphia. I understand, Glenn, that you have a question on prophecy.
Yes. Good morning,
Good morning, Glenn.
When I think about the eschatological or apocalyptic type prophecies from the Old Testament, for which a lot of people are awaiting fulfillment, you know, or looking to say this prophecy hasn't been fulfilled yet, but it must, or the Bible isn't true. I'm thinking about passages such as the burden of Damascus, and I guess in Isaiah, or the Gog, Magog, you know,
whatever
passages in Ezekiel 38-39. A secular scholar might say that these things, are polemics that were levied at potential enemies who never came down against them. And in a sense, they say, well, they were successful polemics because it's not just something that has to be fulfilled, but it was something designed to, like, for example, Ezekiel 38-39, designed to intimidate the Scythians who ultimately never came down against them.
Yeah, what's interesting, of course, is that if you look at what God says is going to happen, particularly as it relates to the Magog War, and Gog is the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, forming the Magog federation, and the nations that comprise it, because God is really detailed into the nations that comprise it, and what they're going to do. And you find that the first listing of nations come from the Caucasus region, which are those Islamic regions that are now have been freed mostly of control by the former Soviet Union. All but Dagestan and Chechistan are independent Islamic countries now, and that they are now able to form a confederation which includes a unified Iran-Iraq as well, which will be ground zero for this, and Pakistan. And then it talks about how the nations really go all the way from Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Syria all the way through northern Africa, and it talks specifically about Libya participating in this, Egypt, the Sudan, and the like. And so God has specifically said that this confederation of nations will attack Israel during the last days, and he has said that he will personally have to intervene to stop them. And he gives great detail about how that he will intervene by making their ability to fly blind, and how he will stop their mechanization. And so really a detailed description of where, when this war is going to be fought and how it's going to be fought. So I understand how somebody who says, you know, I don't want to embrace prophecy, because if I look at the world the way it currently exists and how all these countries are now positioned to come against Israel, and if I look at it that way, and that I have to admit that God predicted exactly what is going to happen, what appears just so imminent on our horizon, then I've got to deal with the fact that the Torah is inspired and that there really is a God, and I don't want to have to deal with that. So I'm just going to wash it all away and say, no, it was written to discourage an enemy. Think of the silliness of that, because the enemy, the Scythians, for example, would never have read it. And if the Scythians had their own gods, they're not going to believe that Yahweh, the God of the Yehudim, was telling the truth. And if they attacked, they were going to be wiped out. It's silliness. Hey, Glenn, we're going to have to go through the commercial break. If you can stay with us. Stay with us, Glenn. We'll be back with Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths today. We're talking with Glenn, calling in from Philadelphia, regarding some of the more interesting prophecies. And there are a lot of unfulfilled prophecies in the Torah prophets and Psalms. Most of them pertain to the last war, which is the Magog War, where it predicts that there's going to be a reaffirmation of a peace treaty between Israel and the surrounding nations, and that immediately after that, that all hell's going to break loose, and that Muslims in unison, and he names the nations, are going to attack Israel, and that Israel this time will not have the ability to hold them off. You had more questions about that?
No, I'd like to take a moment to do a little mis-shattering of my own about the Gog-Magog confrontation.
Sure.
In my Goy Bible, in Ezekiel 39, beginning at the 12th verse, it begins the process of the describes this process of the cleansing of the land and the burning of the fallen. And one key element here that is frequently gotten wrong is this: the people, all the people of the city, go out to bury the soldiers. And it says for 7 months they are burying them. People frequently make the mistake of saying that, and after that, after the 7 months when all the people go out and bury the bodies, then they sever out men of continual employment, contractors, if you will. Then they mark the places where bodies remain, and the contractors go around burying the bodies. Mm-hmm. People frequently make the mistake of thinking that these bodies are contaminated by NBC warfare, nuclear, biological, or chemical warfare. Mm-hmm. This is not the case. If it were the case, all of the people would not be able to be handling those bodies for 7 months.
Of course. And, well, I would agree with you.
I know, but it is, yes, but you'd be surprised. Almost everyone who talks about this, the vast majority of people who reference this, assume that they reference the contractors and say they're contaminated, they have to put flags by the bodies. That is when only a few remain and are scattered all about.
No, and it's months afterwards, right?
Months after.
I don't think that there's any chemical or biological weapon used to thwart the Magog attack on Israel. Right. If I combine what I read and I combine that with the current news, what I see is that the United States primarily has been providing weapons to the Islamic world to a much greater extent. I think the last time I did the math and I compared the amount of weaponry the United States is providing those who would be part of the Magog Federation against Israel versus how much you're giving to Israel, it's somewhere around 25-1. And so we're arming Israel's enemy at about 25 times the rate that we're arming Israel. And so we are going to reach a point where Israel is no longer going to be able to defend herself. And so I see the prophecies becoming a realization that Israel is not going to be able to defend itself from this particular attack by a united Islamic front, and that God does say that he intervenes. I don't think there's any chance in the world that God intervenes with chemical or biological weapons or nuclear weapons. Weapons.
No,
I do think there's going to be a nuclear exchange.
Yeah, I think Israel nukes Damascus, and then all these nations come down to the Magog War.
Yeah, and I do also think that the nuclear exchange is probably between ultimately the surviving arsenals of the United States and Russia, and that much of Europe and the United States is therefore destroyed in that exchange, but that exchange really has nothing to do with God. I think that God will intervene personally and protect Israel, and I don't think there's any chance there's ever going to be a nuclear detonation of any magnitude, of any, you know, destructive magnitude in Israel, because ultimately Israel is God's home. That's where the millennial Shabbat's going to take place.
But the shock and awe, like, oh yeah, well, this arming of the parties makes for good Hegelian dialectic, don't you know?
Absolutely.
And when all this goes down, the only thing that's going to drive these nations to the treaty table for the Antichrist to confirm the treaty is something so horrific that all parties are so undone and just rock back on their heels that they finally go. So yeah, it has to be horrific, horrific in scale and magnitude, and it has to scare everybody into fear of almost annihilation of society, you know, our world as we know it. You know,
Your whole description here is causing me to itch, in the sense of I originally started the project that's become Yada Yah as a desire to pull together all of the statements about the last, say, 20 or so years on this planet as they relate to a prophecy. And as I attempted to do that, I found that there was a story far more important to tell, which is the story of the covenant, how we participate, the story of God's invitations, how we are saved, and I ended up spending the last 10 years on that story. But one of these days, I would love to transition and to focus on the story that what's going to transpire in the next 20 years. Join us again next time, Glenn. I am Yada.